To ask you a question. Do you trust God? Do you trust God? Now, you might say, well, how could you even ask that question with the audience sitting here? We're all professing to be Christians, and obviously we trust God. But it is an important question. Let's go to the book of Proverbs, chapter 3. Proverbs chapter 3. Mr. Call mentioned that we were hooking up with Prestonsburg. That was the original plan, but something unusual happened in the 13 years that we've had services in Prestonsburg. We've never had a guest speaker. Guest speakers have come to Portsmouth, but never to Prestonsburg. Well, this week we had a convergence in the sense that Dave Myers was going to be in down that way because his son is attending medical school at the school there in Pikeville, and so he was going to be down there because it's white coat something or other. So he and his wife were going to be down there, and Larry Salyer is going to be down in that area for a family reunion. Being a Salyer, and Salyersville being a town there, and there are plenty of Salyers, I guess, in that area, so he was going to come down for that. So I got them both this week, and so they're speaking. And so that's a treat for them. But let's go to Proverbs chapter 3 and look at verses 5 and 6. It says here, trust in the Lord with all your heart. Trust in the Lord with all your heart, and lean not on your own understanding. So it says you're to trust God, and trust him to the point where you do not lean on your own understanding in the sense that you trust God. Okay, God, I put this into your hands, and I have my thoughts about how this could work out or what I could do with this, but I'm putting it into your hands to deal with it. I trust you to know what the best course of action is. Now, as we'll see as we look at this subject, it doesn't mean that you don't do anything. But what you do is founded upon a trust in God. It says, in all your ways acknowledge him, and he shall direct your paths. Do you trust God that to the point where you can trust him and avoid leaning on your own understanding, and you will allow him to direct your paths? So what does it mean to trust God? And a question that comes up in light of that is trust the same as faith? Is trust the same as faith, or are they something different? Is trust different from faith? So we'll look at this and we'll examine the subject of, do you trust God? And in the process, we'll try to determine whether there's a difference between faith and trust and see exactly what trust is. Let's go to Psalm 25. Psalm 25 is a psalm that was written by David. And as you read about David in Samuel and 1 Kings, you learn a great deal about the man and the experience that he went through. And you look in the Psalms and you see that David faced health trials. He faced people seeking to overthrow him, undermine him. He was on the run for a while. He had many difficulties in his life. And so he went through a lot of experiences that helped him to develop trust in God. Psalm 25, verse 1. David says, to you, O Lord, I lift up my soul. In essence, he's saying, I depend on you. I place my life into your hands. Verse 2, O my God, I trust in you. I trust in you. So he tells God, I trust you, and I'm trusting you that, he says, let me not be ashamed. Let not my enemies triumph over me. I trust you to the extent that you're not going to allow me to be ashamed. You're not going to allow my enemies to triumph over me. Indeed, let no one who waits on you be ashamed. Let those be ashamed who deal treacherously without cause. There are people that are not living a right life, and their approach to life is one that is hurtful to others. They deal treacherously. And let those people be ashamed. Those who are waiting on God. And that is one of the essential things as you trust God, is you have to wait. It doesn't always work out like you want it to or when you want it to. You have to wait. And David learned that. David learned that he had to wait. And it's interesting, as you look at, if you look at the translation of the word trust in Psalm 25, and where it says trust in Proverbs chapter 3, it's the same Hebrew word, and it means security. Trust conveys the idea of security, quietness, a lack of anxiety, a quietness, a peace that comes from trust. You know, as you really trust somebody and you have confidence in them, then you're not worried about it, are you? You're not worried about it. Okay, they're going to take care of it, and I don't have to worry. So I'm not anxious, I can be at peace, it's quiet, okay? I've entrusted this to whoever it is, and I can be quiet here. And that's what is conveyed by the idea of trusting God, that I've placed it into his hands, and I can just sit back quietly and know that God's going to do his part. You know, trust is something that, as you think about it, it's something that's built. Trust is not established all at once. Trust is something that over time you come to trust somebody. And as you trust them, then you know that, okay, if I give them this duty or this responsibility, I can count on their doing it. They're coming through. They're doing what they're supposed to. Let's look at... So we see here that there's a quietness and a peace here. And as you go on in verses 4 and 5, it says, "Show me your ways, O Lord, teach me your paths." Because, you know, God, I want it to work out your way, and you can show me your path. Show me how you work things out and the proper approach to things. Verse 5, he said, "Lead me in your truth and teach me, for you are the God of my salvation. On you I will wait. I wait all the day. I will wait on you. And I will trust that in your time and in your way, whatever needs to work out will work out." And we asked, is trust and our trust and faith the same? Are they the same? Well, the answer is not really. Not really. Let's go to Romans chapter 8. Romans chapter 8. And look at a scripture that relates to the upcoming Holy Day. Romans chapter 8. Verses 9 through 11. Romans chapter 8, verses 9 through 11. Verse 9 says, "But you are not in the flesh, but in the Spirit indeed, if the Spirit of God dwells in you. So if you've come to repentance, you've been baptized, your sins have been washed away, and God, through the laying on of hands, places his Spirit in the Christian. Now, if anyone does not have the Spirit of Christ, he is not his." You're not a Christian unless God's Spirit dwells in you. Verse 10, "And if Christ is in you, the body is dead because of sin, but the Spirit is life because of righteousness. But if the Spirit of him who raised Jesus from the dead dwells in you," so if you have God's Spirit, "he who raised Christ from the dead will also give life to your mortal bodies through his Spirit who dwells in you." What's he telling us? He's telling us that if I die tomorrow, God will fulfill his promise, and he will resurrect me at the coming of Christ. That is the promise that is given to all of us as Christians. It is a promise that God has made. We can count on it. So it's speaking there of the resurrection of the just, and as you look at it, it's pretty clear and straightforward. We look at what it says, and that's what God's going to do. But how does trust relate to this? So we have faith that God has made promises and he will fulfill them. So, but trust comes into play when we face trials. Trust comes into play when we face trials. You see, you can have the belief in the coming resurrection of the dead. But the question is, when you face trials in your Christian life, will you endure to the end in order that you can experience the resurrection of the dead? And sometimes the trial that you face is going to challenge you to be faithful, challenge you to stick with it to the end. Now, sometimes we face trials when it comes to, an example of a trial we might face is financial problems. You know, as you look at financial problems, which are a challenge to people at this, have always been a challenge, but I think especially a challenge at this time, can God help us? Absolutely. But trust comes in as we place the matter in God's hand and we do everything we can do. Do we quietly and peacefully wait on God? When you're facing financial troubles, that's sometimes hard to do. I know that just from a personal experience, my wife and I bought our first house in Pekin, Illinois. And so it was a small house in a small community, so we owned the house, and we had lived there for a while, and then we were transferred to St. Louis. So the first shocker as we transferred to St. Louis was how much more expensive it was to live in St. Louis as opposed to where we were living in Illinois. So our cost of living was going to skyrocket. So then we put the house on the market in the worst economic situation around there in a long time. So here we are trying to sell our house in the midst of a really tough market. So we prayed about it and we fasted about it, and we placed it in God's hands, and you're really confident, and sadly this may not be a good example, but we were kind of on the roller coaster here. Okay, everything's going to work out. We put it in God's hands. God's going to hear our prayer and take care of this. And then it didn't happen, and you're up and you're down, and you're up and you're down. And, that's how it is when you're facing a trial that goes on. You're not sure when God's going to take care of it. And there are days when you're confident and days when you're not. And it's hard. What God is working with us to do is to be steady and to be confident in him at all times, but we being human sometimes aren't that way. But that's the thing that God is trying to develop in us, is to trust him and to peacefully wait for him to work it out. And probably if you have experienced a trial and you've asked God to help you with it, and it goes on, and it's easy. We can wait a short time. Hey, okay, a couple of days, come on. But that's not always the way it works. Let's go to Psalm 37. Psalm 37. And David wrote quite a few psalms about trusting in God because, as I said, he went through a lot of experiences. And some you might say, well, why did he go through so many trials? Maybe it was because God was ensuring that he came to trust in God. Because if you're going to place David over the people of Israel, you're going to have him rule over that great nation then you're going to have somebody with who really, truly, deeply trusts God. And David does. Came to that point in his life. David came to recognize something through the experiences that he went through, and he recounts them here in Psalm 37, verse 25. He said, I've been young. I've been young and knew that God was with me and watching out for me as I faced the lion and the bear and protecting the sheep. I know that God was with me as a young man as I stood out there on the field of battle against Goliath. And I asked God to help me as I faced that giant and as I spun that sling above my head and let go of that rock, and it hit him in the forehead and down he went. I experienced those things. I've also made terrible mistakes in my life and gone through all sorts of trials, some of which I brought on myself. I've been young and now am old. Yet I have not seen the righteous forsaken, nor his descendants begging bread. You know, at some time in your life, you'll probably be asked the question, if you were in a plane crash out in the middle of nowhere, and you had no food, and it came down to you being a cannibal, would you do it as a Christian? What's the answer to that? Well, absolutely not. Because what? You have confidence that somehow, some way, God is going to come through for you. Now, I can't tell you how that's going to happen, but that's not the solution. So when somebody asks you that, say, well, first of all, it's hypothetical. I won't fly. I'm never getting on a plane. But anyway, that's not the answer. But the thing is, God is going to somehow come through for you, but you can't say how that's going to happen. So if God could use ravens to bring food to Elijah, he could do it then, he can do it now. So God somehow is going to see you through. And you have to have that confidence. And what he's telling us here is I've lived my life and gone through all the ups and downs of life, and through that whole experience, I have not seen the righteous forsaken, nor his descendants begging bread. I just haven't seen that. Now, can life be tough? Absolutely. You know, you look at the widow in the story with Elisha, and they're out of food. She's out of food. She and her son, this is it. This is going to be our last, tortilla or whatever I'm going to make today. This is it. We're done. No more oil, no more flour. And then here comes Elisha. He shows up, and he said, hey, they've only got this little bit left. Make me something to eat. The gall of this guy. We're all starving here, and you expect me to give up my last food for you? But she does. And you know what? God provided for her in a miraculous way, for all of them in a miraculous way. Now, I'm not, I don't know how more food comes into that barrel or more oil into that jug, but obviously they had it each day, what they needed. Now, they weren't living, richly, but they did sustain life. And sometimes that's what it may come down to. We know that that God will not forsake the righteous, that he will somehow come through for us, but we don't know when relief will come, and we don't know how much we'll have to go through in the process. But we want to trust God. And I'd like to just cite an example of trust. A man went to an auction, and at the auction, he bought a painting. And made the purchase, and so when you make a purchase at an auction, they expect you to pay at the end of the auction. So you have to make settle the deal right then and there. So as he's getting ready to leave and to pay for his painting, he realizes, I don't have my checkbook. And so he checked his wallet, and he didn't have enough cash to cover it either. So he thought, well, I'll go back to the third option, which is credit card, my credit card. But then there was a little sign there that said that they couldn't accept credit cards there today. Oops. No more options. But in talking to the receptionist told him, well, we can run your credit card, but usually we have the credit card reader here and we don't have that here, but I can write down your number and we'll call it in and we'll take care of the transaction, and then we'll tear up the paper on which we wrote down all of your information for your credit card. Well, how many of you would give the auctioneer your credit card information? Well, probably not. But you know, if you're dealing with an auctioneer, that auctioneer, is he going to misuse your credit card? Probably not, because he probably lives in a particular community and he has a reputation to maintain. So if he misuses your credit card information, he's going to soil his good name. So the person who bought the painting agreed to this, and he did so because he felt the auctioneer had a vested interest to protect his good name. And trust in God is like that. It's based on God's name and his character. You can trust God because he is God, and because God's character is set. It's the same yesterday, today, and forever. And this should be our stance toward God, our overall approach. Because of his name and character, we trust him. Now, as you think about faith and trust, faith itself flows from specific promises. For instance, you might have seen the bumper sticker that says, God says it, I believe it, and that's that. You may have seen that. And trust comes from the knowledge of God's character. As it says in the book of John, that God is love. And what does that mean? It means that everything that God does is always based upon love, upon outgoing concern for everyone involved. And that in knowing that, we believe that God will always do what's best for us as his children. Let's go over to Psalm 31. Psalm 31, which is a petition that David made to God. Psalm 31, verse 1. Psalm 31, verse 1. David says, in you, O Lord, I put my trust. Let me never be ashamed. Deliver me in your righteousness. Bow down your ear to me. Deliver me speedily. I mean, we all want speedy delivery. Be my rock of refuge. You know, as I need protection, be my rock of refuge, of a fortress of defense to save me. For you are my rock and my fortress. Therefore, for your name's sake, lead me and guide me. Pull me out of the net which they have secretly laid for me, for you are my strength. Into your hand I commit my spirit. You have redeemed me, O Lord, Lord God of truth. I have hated those who regard useless idols, but I trust in the Lord. He's making a petition here that God would watch out for him and protect him, that God would be his rock and his fortress, and that he would lead him, and that he would pull him out of the net. And, you know, when people are secretly laying for your downfall, you don't always know that, do you? They're out to get you. But if they're doing it in secret, you know, maybe you'll discover the secret, maybe you won't. So you know, it's good to have God looking out for you. That God is watching out for you, and that God is going to protect you. That God, because there are sometimes things that we don't see or that are going on, but God is aware of them, and God can protect us. Into your hand I commit my spirit. And that's what we have to do. We have to commit ourselves into God's hand. Let's go to Psalm 34, which talks about our trusting God and tells us something about why we can trust God. And it's interesting the way that this is stated. Psalm 34, verse 8. It says, "O taste and see that the Lord is good. Blessed is the man who trusts in Him." How can you trust in God? And this is interesting because, you know, one of the things that a lot of people that don't believe in God or aren't sure about God want to know, he says, you know, if I could see God, I would believe in Him. Now, really, would they? You just look at the Pharisees and the leaders of the Jews. Did they see God? Absolutely they did. Did He say, "I am God"? Did He do miracles? Did He do everything possible to show them that He was God? Did they believe Him? No, they killed Him. And, you know, in the coming resurrection, it's going to be real interesting. To maybe have Christ go through. Let's go back and look at these DVDs or whatever, these different things that happened here, and you guys never got it. You know, these guys are going to be sinking down in their chair and thinking, oh man, this is going to go badly. It's going to be obvious that He was the Messiah once they go back and look at it, but they couldn't see it in their time. But anyway, you know, people wanted, you know, they said, if I could see God, if I could touch Him and all of this, then I would believe in Him. You know, if I could, you know, sense Him in that way. And, you know, we have our five senses. And what's He talking about here? He's talking about two of your senses. He said, oh, taste and see. Not only can we taste Him, but we can see Him. So to know that God is good is something that is tangible, that we can come through our experiences to know. Through your senses, it's telling you. So we can trust God as a result of getting to know Him, to taste Him. He goes on to say here, "Oh, fear the Lord, you His saints. There is no want to those who fear Him. The young lions lack and suffer hunger, but those who seek the Lord shall not lack any good thing." You know, as you look at, you know, it talks about the young lions. You know, a lion is a very aggressive and powerful hunter. And the young lions are especially adept at doing what lions do well, finding food, running it down, and killing it. And yet it says, those lions which have all the skill, they suffer hunger. But those who seek the Lord, those, you know, as you think about those who seek the Lord, they are anything but lions. But those who seek the Lord shall not lack any good thing. How would you know that? Well, like it says, taste and see that the Lord is good. You can taste it, you can see it, and blessed is the man who trusts in Him. So God is reliable, and God is trustworthy. And God loves His people, and He always does what's best for them. And trust is something that is built. It is built in our course of life as we have a relationship with God. And we go through various things and God is there with us as we go through those experiences and God is with us and helps us through them. Then it should reinforce that God is trustworthy. And we as we mature in the faith, we trust Him and we say, you know what? I don't enjoy this, and this is not pleasant, but I trust that God's going to work it out. Now, let's look at a few points here that emphasize some things about trusting in God. First of all, trust in God isn't passive. So if we trust God, does that mean we don't do anything? Well, I put it into God's hands. I'm going to sit back and wait. Well, think about it. If you want to get married and you never leave the house, are you going to get married? Well, I put it in God's hands. I'm going to wait on God. Well, you're going to wait forever. Unless it's the post lady, it's not going to, or some delivery person. No, no girls are coming to your house, fellas. And guys, you know, it's not going to, or ladies, it's not going to happen the other way. You've got to take some action. If you want a job and you're just stay at home, it's not going to happen. You've got to go look for a job. Let's look at an example of this, that trust in God isn't passive. It's an example that took place in the time of King Saul, time of when David was serving under King Saul, and the people of Israel were dealing with the Philistine threat. Let's go to 1 Samuel 13. 1 Samuel 13. Samuel 13, verse 19. 1 Samuel 13, verse 19. Verse 19 tells us something about the condition at the time in the nation of Israel. It says, "Now there was no blacksmith to be found throughout all the land of Israel, for the Philistines said, 'Lest the Hebrews make swords or spears.'" So there were no Israelitish blacksmiths in Israel. So if you wanted something sharpened or you needed to go to the blacksmith, what did you do? Verse 20. "But all the Israelites would go down to the Philistines to sharpen each man's plowshare, his mattock, his axe, and his sickle. And the charge for a sharpening was a pim for the plowshares, the mattocks, the forks, and the axes, and to set the points of the goads. So it came about on the day of battle that there was neither sword nor spear found in the hand of any of the peoples who were with Saul and Jonathan. But they were found with Saul and Jonathan, his son." So here, they're on the brink of a battle, and the only people with implements of war are Jonathan and Saul. And the Philistines, who have the blacksmiths in their nation, they're all well armed. So who's going to win this contest? If you're just looking at it physically, so they're only David and, or Saul and Jonathan had implements of war. Let's go to chapter 14, verse 1. "Now it happened one day that Jonathan, the son of Saul, said to the young man who bore his armor, 'Come, let us go over to the Philistines' garrison that is on the other side.'" So they go across the valley to the other side of where the Philistines are. But he didn't tell his father. Verse 2, "And Saul was sitting in the outskirts of Gibeah under a pomegranate tree, which is in Migron. The people who were with him were about 600 men. Ahijah, the son of Ahadab, Ichabod's brother, the son of Phinehas, the son of Eli, the Lord's priest, and Shiloh was wearing an ephod. But the people did not know that Jonathan had gone. Between the passes by which Jonathan sought to go over to the Philistines' garrison, there was a sharp rock on one side and a sharp rock on the other. And the name of one was Bozez and the other was Sinna. The front of one faced northward, opposite Michmash, and the other southward, opposite Gibeah. Verse 6, "Then Jonathan said to his man who bore his armor, 'Come, let us go over to the garrison of these uncircumcised. It may be that the Lord will work for us. For nothing restrains the Lord from saving by many or few.'" So they went over, and he said, well, God could help it to work out. God could help this to work out. And even though Jonathan had implements of war, the Philistines were overwhelmingly superior. And what did he say? He said, it may be that the Lord will work for us. What was his attitude as he went out? Well, his attitude was, who knows? He displayed an attitude of courage, and yet he wasn't absolutely certain that which way it would work out. He wasn't afraid, but he trusted in God, that God could work it out. And God did. And what he did here actually led to Israel's victory. But it was God involved. And, you know, as we deal with things, we have to say, you know what? I've got to take it. I've got to, you know, give this a shot I don't exactly know how this is going to work out or if it will. And so I got, like he said, in verse 6 there, he said, it may be that the Lord will work for us. And as you venture forth, it may be that the Lord will work for you. For nothing restrains the Lord from saving by many or few. Now, a second point is, when should we be passive? When should we not do anything? And when should we be active? Well, let's look at an example in Ecclesiastes chapter 11. Ecclesiastes chapter 11. Let's look at verses 1 through 6. And I'm going to read this in the read this from the Complete Jewish Bible, because the way it's worded, I thought was a little clearer and hopefully would be helpful. You can follow along in whatever version you had. Ecclesiastes 11, verses 1 through 6. It says, "Send your resources out over the seas." The flowery wording in the King James or the New King James is, "Cast your bread upon the waters." And what it means is, send your resources out over the seas. Eventually, you will reap a return. And it's speaking of, you know, if you are a merchant, then you acquire goods and you put them on a ship and you're sending them out to ports. And your hope is that all these goods will be sold and you will make a profit. And so as you send that, you gather the goods and you put them on the ship, you're praying that God is going to bless what you're doing. But you don't know that it's at, you know, the ship could sink. You're going to get nothing then. You've lost it all. You may sell all your goods, you may not. You may find out nobody wants your goods and you have to sell them at a discount. You know, different things can happen. But we're told here to send your resources out over the seas. Eventually, you will reap a return. It says in verse 2, divide your merchandise into 7 or 8 shares. So, you know, if you had merchandise, maybe it would be wise to put it on 7 or 8 ships versus one. That way, if they get one ship and it sinks to the bottom of the sea, maybe the other 6 or 7 will make it. So don't just, sometimes it's wise to give yourself more options of how things might go, since you don't know what disasters may come on the earth. Verse 3, if clouds are full of rain, they empty themselves on the earth. Whether a tree falls toward the north or the south, the place where the tree falls is where it stays. So, you know, clouds eventually dump their rain on the earth and trees fall, and that's where they fall. You just pray that what's best works out. Verse 4, he who keeps watching the wind will never sow. You know, if you wait for perfect conditions, you'll never sow. How many of you would have had children if you were waiting for when you could afford them? You know? Really, you can never afford them. And I don't know how you get through having kids and paying for all the stuff that goes with it. I mean, they're not cheap. You know, so the thing is, if you wait for perfect conditions, he's saying, if you wait till the wind's just right, or as it goes on to say, he who keeps looking at the clouds will never reap. Well, you know, when the conditions are perfect, we'll get out there and we'll get the crops in. You'll never do it because it's never perfect. You get a rare day once in a while. You know, and I know that I've been like the guy in the Proverbs here, waiting to put stuff on my deck, seal my deck. Well, it's never perfect in Ohio. What day is it not going to rain? I mean, or a chance of rain. So thankfully, there are a few days here when the week when there was no rain, I couldn't get the product I needed. So then I finally got it, and it's working out, so I'm thankful for that. But, you know, if you just always look for perfect conditions, when are those perfect conditions? You cannot just sit back passively until it's all perfect. You have to venture forth and give yourself options of the way things can go. Verse 5 says, just as you don't know the way of the wind or how bones grow in a pregnant woman's womb, so you don't know the work of God, the maker of everything. You don't know God's mind. You don't know the way how God's going to work something out. You don't know that. But if you trust in God, then it will work out. It will work out for the best. Verse 6 says, in the morning sow your seed. You know, venture forth, put your seed out. And don't slack off until evening. Keep working at it. Keep working until time runs out, for you don't know which sowing will succeed, this or that, or if both will do well. You don't know. So you've got to, you can't just sit back passively. You've got to give yourself options, but you've got to take action. You've got to take action. And, you know, as we've seen, you know, trust in God isn't something that's just passive, and we should take action. So, you know, as you're looking for a job, you know, don't just settle for one. I'm only going to do one thing. Look in different places at different jobs. As you look at personal matters like dating, you know, give yourself options. Give yourself opportunities. God's direction can be unpredictable because God can answer in ways we don't anticipate. And why is that? Because God wants us to come to trust Him. He's building trust. He's helping us to build trust in Him, to have confidence in Him, to know that we can count on Him in whatever circumstance we're in. That's why we face trials that keep, you know, we go from this one to that one. We have periods of peace maybe, but we move on to another trial. And the reason is God is teaching us something in the process. The third point is, okay, but sometimes it seems I've done all I can. Really? Now it's in God's hands. Does it ever reach that point where you've done all you can and now it really is in God's hands? Let's look at an example in Exodus chapter 14. Exodus chapter 14. God, in working with the nation of Israel, was seeking to build trust for them to come to trust Him. Now, Moses had come to trust God, but Israel really hadn't. Even with all the miracles that had taken place in Egypt and God working with them in really miraculous ways, they still didn't trust Him. So here, as it talks about in Exodus chapter 14, it describes that Israel, following being led by God out into the wilderness and being trapped between the mountains and the sea with the Egyptian army behind them, which from their perspective was just, what have you led us into, Moses? And really it wasn't Moses leading him, it was the pillar of fire by day. But here they are stuck. Here they are with no way out. And so they're very unhappy with Moses and ultimately with God. But look at what it says beginning in verse 10. Exodus 14, verse 10. And when Pharaoh drew near, the children of Israel lifted their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians marched after them. So they were very afraid, and the children of Israel cried out to the Lord. Then they said to Moses, a lot of negative things. You know, you couldn't have let us just suffer and die in Egypt? We would have been better off there than out here in the wilderness. And Moses said to the people in verse 13, do not be afraid. Stand still and see the salvation of the Lord, which He will accomplish for you today. For the Egyptians whom you see today, you shall see again no more forever. The Lord will fight for you, and you shall hold your peace. Sometimes that's where the point we come to. We're between the mountains. The sea is before us, and behind us is an army, and there is no way out. And it probably all of us in our life, in some way, shape, or form, are going to arrive to that point. And the question we have to ask is that point is, there's nothing I can do. I have no way out of this. God, I know you helped Israel. The only way out of this is you're going to have to part the Red Sea in my situation here. Will you do that? God can't he? So sometimes that's how we are. We have to trust in God that he would somehow change the situation, somehow intervene to help us. Because there is no other option. There is no other place we can turn. So sometimes we just have to stand still and see the salvation of God. And it reminds us that sometimes we've done everything we can, but it's God who's going to have to work it out. And as he takes us through a situation like that, we hopefully see what's taken place there. We see that somehow God is part of the waters, and we're able to go to the other side. God is able to do that. And as he takes us through a situation like that, the goal is to develop implicit trust. We just implicitly trust him. A fourth thing to consider as we think about trust in God is that sometimes we can be too independent. We can be too independent. Sometimes it's like we say, okay, I trust God, but here's my plan. And let's look at how our plans are to be filtered. James chapter 4. James chapter 4. James chapter 4, verse 13. It says, come now, you who say today or tomorrow, we will go to such and such a city, spend a year there, buy and sell and make a profit. Whereas you do not know what will happen tomorrow. For what is your life? It is even a vapor that appears for a little time and then vanishes away. You know, for all of us, will there even be a tomorrow? We can't. I mean, we hope there will be, but we don't know for sure. I know that this week I was making plans with a couple of other ministers, and we're going to planning a backpacking trip at the end of June next year. Okay, that's the plan. But you know, what's going to happen between now and next June? All kinds of things could happen. But the thing is, you plan, and if it's God's will, it'll work out. But it may not work out. And, you know, things can happen, but if it's God's will, then we'll do that. If it's not, then we won't. So what we have to realize is our lives can change so quickly, and so what we have to do is we have to think about what's God's will. And that's the point he's making here, and he points out what we should do in verse 15. Instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we shall live and do this or that. If it is God's will, we'll do this or that. So we need to have a plan, but it must be submitted to God first. It must be filtered by God. And this isn't being passive, it's an element of trust. So we make a plan, but we ask God to guide and direct in what is best. Because things can change very, very quickly. So we're not to be Christian jellyfish or blobs that are just floating on the river of life and just floating along with no plan. We should have plans, but we should submit them to God. And we need to declare, my life is in your hands, God. I trust you, and I have a plan. But is it the best plan? Is it the best way to go? This is what I'd like to do. What is best? And if it's God's will, then ask him to let the plan come to pass. And if God has plans for you or me that are different from what we've planned, then trust God that he knows what he's doing. You know, as you think about your life, has your life exact? And you know, think about when you were 20, and where you were at. Now, when you were 20, did you plan on being where you are today? How many of you planned it, and it's just exactly gone according to the plan when you were 20. All right, you're maybe a few years older than that. So are you doing exactly what you thought you would do as far as a job? Are you living where you thought you would live? Most of us aren't. I mean, I planned on living in California. I'm glad I live here, but I planned on this. I didn't know. Did I plan on marrying a Canadian? No, but my wife probably thought that I plan on marrying an American. You know, am I going to give up Zedding and start Zing? Zed is how they say Z in Canada, by the way. So, am I going to give that up? She didn't know. But see, your life kind of carry, you know, as God works with you and leads you, your life doesn't exactly go always according to your plan. So have plans, but submit them to God and say, God, what's best for me? Help that to work out. sometimes we say, I've turned it over to God, and that's a very big challenge. Peter talks about that. And it's interesting that Peter should talk about this because of his experience, which we'll recount briefly. 1 Peter chapter 5. Now, as you think about Peter, one of the stories that is recorded for us in the Bible, and we'll look at 1 Peter chapter 5 here in a moment, it's recorded in Matthew chapter 14, and Christ was not with those who became the apostles. They were out on the lake, and a storm came up, and the ship is rocking, and the conditions are less than ideal. And one of them looks out from the ship or the boat and notices that here comes Christ walking on the water toward them. And so Peter, being the impetuous one, it's Jesus, and he's all excited. And so Peter, being a fisherman and working on the sea all the time, realizes, you know what, if I jump out of this boat, I'm going right to the bottom. You're going to sink. You're going to go underwater. But Peter, being impetuous, he starts walking toward Christ, doesn't he? And as long as he's focused on Christ, he's doing something that is physically not possible. But once he begins to think about, wait, hold on here. I'm walking across the water to Christ. The waves are, there's the wind's blowing and the waves are going up and down all around me, and this is not possible. And what does he do? He sinks. Christ saves him. But there was a lesson to that. And I think in Peter's life, he came to understand that more fully, the importance of trusting in God, because he brings it up here in 1 Peter chapter 5. And you don't think that that experience had an impact on what Peter says here? I think it did. 1 Peter chapter 5, verses 6 and 7. It says, therefore, humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God. Humbly walk before God, that he may exalt you in due time. Humility is crucial to our lives as Christians. Humility is crucial to our being exalted. And verse 7 says, casting all your care upon him, for he cares for you. We have cares, we have concerns, we have challenges. And you see, as we humble ourselves before God and recognize our shortcomings and recognize our spiritual poverty and our need for God, then God will lift us up. God will exalt us. God will help us through the challenges that we face. He'll help us in order that we can surmount whatever obstacles we face. And the challenge we face is we turn something over to God. We cast it to him and ask him to take care of it, is many times we're really unwilling to do it. We say it, but it's pretty easy for us to lose confidence in God and then try to snatch it back. And we have to be careful about doing that. Because once you snatch it back and you begin to operate in the physical realm, then what are you going to do? You're just like Peter, and you're going to what? You're going to sink. But as you continue to cast your care upon God and trust in him, then he's going to help you walk on the water in a sense. I don't recommend you go home and try to walk on the water. But by example, that's the point he's making. God is going to help you do things you couldn't do on your own. So as you cast your care upon him, then leave it with God and trust that he's going to come through for you. So I'd like to conclude the sermon with a story. It's really a story that helps to make the point. And the story is about an amazing trapeze artist. And he was a trapeze artist that could string the rope or whatever to the wire between two points, and he could ride a cycle up on that tightrope. And this individual claimed that he could tightrope across Niagara Falls. He could walk across it. He could cycle across it. So he, usually when people are doing feats like this, they're trying to attract an audience. That's how they make their money. So people heard about this, and spectators came from far and wide to watch this particular feat. People were waiting with bated breath to watch him do the impossible feat, but somehow they had the belief that the trapeze artist would probably succeed. Now, you know, in any event like this, there's always the person that's hoping he's going to fall off. You know, when Evel Knievel was jumping over 20 buses or whatever he was doing, there was always that group that was there, man, I hope he crashes and burns, you know. And Evel did that several times for his audience and was a pretty broken and battered person by the end of his life. Then the trapeze artist not only skillfully crossed to the other side, but also cycled his way back to glory. And there was thunderous applause celebrating the expertise and courage of the man. And then, to the surprise of everyone, the artist invited a volunteer from the crowd to accompany him in doing this again. So he said, look, I need a volunteer, and we'll cycle across the Niagara Falls together. How many of you would volunteer for that? I don't care how good he is. I'm not getting on there with him. Not going to happen. I'd probably panic, and then we would fall off the tightrope. So anyway, nobody came forward from the crowd. Until then, everyone had so much belief in his ability and was convinced that he would succeed, but now no one dared even to contemplate the risk involved. Suddenly, from nowhere, a little girl made her way out of the crowd and said, I will come with you. The artist smiled, but there was a deathly silence, and everybody looked at this crazy man going to take this child on this cycle across Niagara Falls. They said that the girl was crazy, and so was the guy that was going to carry her across the falls. When they saw that neither the girl nor the man would relent, they cursed and abused the trapeze artist for his irresponsible behavior in risking the life of another human being. It was so ironic to witness the scene. It was the same crowd that a few moments before was praising the artist. The trapeze artist, along with the little girl, started the great crossing, and the crowd was too shocked and staggered even to voice his displeasure. They were absolutely sure that there would be a ghastly outcome to this adventure. But to everyone's great relief, the trapeze artist, along with his little enthusiast, crossed over safely. And the crowd, though relieved, again criticized the artist. What are you thinking? And then the child looked up at the artist and said, Papa, let's go home. The entire crowd was stunned. Then the child then said, I have full trust in my father's ability, and I know that I am secure and safe in my papa's arms. And that's something that God wants us to come to feel, that we are safe in our father's arms. We are, and we always will be, and this is the essence of trust.